In Daniel chapter 8, we read, beginning in verse 3, I lifted up my eyes and saw, and there, standing beside the river, was a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. Now, if you are looking at Persia, which he tells us later on that this is indeed in verse 20 of chapter 8, the ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. This is not up to imagination. They explain. He explains what he's referring to. So it's not, well, is this the end time? I shouldn't have to do that. He explains what it is and tells me what it is. He says that these are the kings of Mede and Persia. He says, I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. That's what we've studied up to this point. We've seen Persia conquering just about anybody they came up against. The only people that they couldn't really conquer was Scythia to the north, and that's largely because there was no real reason for going up there. There were no political boundaries that the Scythians had. They were plains roamers. They moved all over the place. Not only that, but their military tactics were very difficult to battle against when fighting in a conventional way. Other than that, they conquered just about anybody that they went after, to the point where all of the recognizable kingdoms of the Middle East were under Persian rule. However, it says in verse 5, as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. It points out here that there is a ram with two large horns, one raised up over the other. He destroys anything he comes up against. And then we're introduced to a goat in the west. And what was west of Persia at this point? Greece. That's exactly right. Greece was this area right in here. It was west of Persia. And it points out that it rises up. Now what?
Tell her, but I can't hear.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and... All right, and we were looking at the fact that there is a goat in the west. That goat is the Grecian Empire. Now, my question is, what's stronger, a ram or a goat? I would think a ram. And that's the point being made, is that a ram with two large horns is much stronger than a goat. Or at least it seems to be that way. But the unusual happens. The remarkable, the unthinkable happens. The goat wins. When we keep reading, it says in verse 6, and he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to withstand him. But he cast him down to the ground and trampled him. And there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. And this is that we're going to be looking at this morning. That ram. We're going to be looking at, in particular, the notable horn that is on the ram. And what we see is, in verse 21, the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. And that is who we're studying this morning. As you can see in front of you on your notes, we're looking at Alexander the Great. As he's known, the apostle of Hellenism, the one who sent, who went and scattered the culture of Hellenism all over the known world at that time. So let's go ahead and begin by examining his father, Philip II of Macedon. Philip II of Macedon. As early as the days of Xerxes, Greek power had been increasing. They had collaborated more in that time period than they had in their entire history. Because before that, they were largely independent from one another, that each polis or each city was self-governing and really didn't have anything to do with the others. They were united in culture and maybe in currency, but that was about it. So with that scene, under Philip II, he actually begins to unite them under one rule. The city-states of Greece, before this, weren't united. After Philip, they were. He was not able to include Sparta because it's believed that he was murdered by Olympia, his wife, in 336 BC. And that then the the crown, the right to rule, falls to his son Alexander. Now, the reason that Olympia probably did this is because it was believed that Philip II was cutting her and Alexander out of the succession. Maybe it was just a paranoid move on her part, but it's believed to be Olympia. So then Alexander comes to the throne, and he was given a commission by his father right before he died to take the war to Persia, to go after Persia. Greece had been increasing their strength. Persia was waning. We've looked at Persia in quite a bit of detail, and they were on the decline. They were not getting stronger. They were getting weaker. Let's look at Alexander for a moment. Alexander was a Macedonian by nationality. He came from Macedonia, and that's where his heritage was. However, culturally, he was a Greek. So understand that nationality is the political borders you find yourself in. So he could have been Spartan by nationality, but he can be Greek by heritage or by culture. He could be an Athenian by nationality, but be a Persian by culture, so because the cultures were different. So he was Macedonian, that's where his home was. However, he was culturally a Greek, and that's important because he's going to see the need to take this culture all over the known world at the time. He was educated by Aristotle himself. You may have heard of Aristotle before. Well, Alexander the Great had him as a personal tutor. That would have been something. He carried the Iliad and the Odyssey with him on his campaigns, that he would frequently read from the Iliad and the Odyssey. Well, he is, after all, a conqueror. He reads books about conquering. With a small army, largely of Macedonians, and a staff of historians, geographers, and botanists, he did not just go about to just conquer and burn everything from there to the Indus River. What he was doing is he was actually going through and documenting everything and anything that he found. His mission was not solely to destroy everything he came across. He largely wanted to share the culture and increase and enrich that culture of Hellenism. So that's what he set about to do. He did not only bring soldiers with him, he brought a lot of actually civilians with him as well. He crossed the Dardanelles by boat at the very spot where Xerxes had taken his army. Do you remember the ship bridge that we looked at? And that actually ended up falling apart on Xerxes. That same spot is where Alexander the Great is going to cross. Although it wouldn't be on a ship bridge. Darius III did not take the expedition seriously. Darius III is also notably... Well, what's notable about Darius III? If you have your sheet or your supplement with you, what's special about Darius III?
He's the one that lost to Alexander.
He's the last Persian king. He's the last one. And he didn't take it seriously. He did not take the fact that Alexander was coming across that small inlet. He didn't take it seriously. He got together a large army, and he was going to meet Alexander and fight against him. He ordered that Alexander be seized and brought to Susa. It was a close fight. Alexander nearly lost his life. The Persians were defeated. With this victory, the way into Asia Minor lay open before Alexander. In 333 BC, we're going to jump ahead to 333 BC, and you're going to be able to see just how far Macedonia, or Alexander, was able to push into Persian territory. So give that just a moment to catch up. In 333 BC, Alexander met the Persian army, not just the group that was designed to capture him and bring him back. He met the entire Persian army, which was estimated to be between 100,000 and 300,000 soldiers. To give you, that is a tremendous army. That's a tremendous size. And despite these odds, Alexander won at the Battle of Issus. Issus is an important battle because it marks the turning point between the Persian power and Grecian power. It marks that change where Persia was in control, handing that over to Alexander the Great. Just like Carchemish was where Assyria hands it over to Babylon, the Battle of Issus is going to be where Alexander receives or takes the power from Persia. So that's important to note. And you can see, of course, as soon as he wins that victory, he heads right into the Middle East. He does not stop. And he takes a tremendous amount of territory very, very quickly. And he's not going to stop there. He actually won through a triumph of tactics. Before this point, tactics was not something that was highly studied. The word strategy is actually a Greek word that stands for the general of an army. The strategos is, or the strategos is, the general of the army. And so strategy was largely a Greek concept. And before they really started spreading all over the world, largely, if you had more soldiers on the field than the other guy, you were probably going to win because you could just overrun them. However, Alexander brought something interesting to the table. If you've ever heard of the hammer and anvil strategy, that was Alexander's creation. And that's where, you remember the phalanxes we looked at with all of the spears pointed out front. He would form long lines of these, and they would hold their ground. And what he would do with his cavalry, with his soldiers on horseback, is he would ride around behind his opponent, and if those spears are the anvil, what do you think the cavalry are? They're the hammer. And so as those soldiers run into those spears and they're trying to fight their way through the spears, they were getting hit from behind with cavalry, and that would cause the enemy army to panic. It would cause them to fight on all sides instead of just one. And because of this, he was pulling off tremendous victories, despite being outnumbered against the Persians. They had been so confident of this victory that the officers brought their families to watch the spectacle. They brought and basically made a show of it, made a picnic out of it. Alexander captured them, along with a sizable portion of the Persian treasury, the king's wife, mother, and children, 360 of his concubines, 400 eunuchs, and even the ambassadors to the Persian court from Athens, Thebes, and Sparta. Talk about walking away with the spoils of war. He just about single-handedly decapitated Persia in one fight, in one battle, because they brought all of the nobles, all of the rulers there, and then they lost. And you may think of a civil war battle that followed somewhat like this, that the South was able to win, and a lot of Northerners came out to actually watch the fight, and it was a shock that they actually lost to them. So this is not, I guess, unprecedented, that this was common to happen. If someone thought it was going to be just a stomp, they would bring their families, and that was unfortunate for the Persians because that turned out to be a disaster. Alexander's next battle was his longest, and that is the city of Tyre. The city of Tyre. Now, if you're looking at the map here, you probably know about where Tyre is already, but Tyre is going to be just right off the coast here, right about where that arrow is. That's where Tyre is, and Tyre is actually it's off of the mainland. The city was not attached to the mainland. And that's why it was going to be Alexander's longest. It had withstood sieges from Sennacherib and Nebuchadnezzar, two men that had just about conquered anything else they came across, with the exception for Sennacherib, Jerusalem. But even Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem. And so Tyre, however, had withstood them because of where it was located. Alexander now conquers it in 7 months. Now, it would take some rulers years to take cities like that, and Alexander does it in 7 months, which was unheard of. And he did it by building a causeway from the mainland out to the city and then moving siege towers up next to the city walls, which caught them completely by surprise because you don't expect to defend yourself from siege towers if there's no way to roll a siege tower out there. Go ahead.
This was the answer to prophecy. God prophesied this.
He did. He did tell Tyre that that's exactly what would happen. Certainly. Certainly. All right, let's go ahead and look at the next area that he conquers, it says that he continued into Egypt, where the joyful Egyptians welcomed him as a liberator from the hated Persians. By this point, the Egyptians, and you've probably picked up on this as we covered lessons 1 and 2, the Egyptians were not happy being ruled by Persia. They were not happy with it, and they were revolting at every point. They thought it would be a good idea to do it, which was frequently. And time again, they'd have to be put down, and they'd have to be put down again. And the Greeks were actually long allies of Egypt. If you remember, when we were reading about all of those conflicts, all of those revolts, who comes to the aid of Egypt just about every time? Greece. Greece sent ships there, but they were never successful in liberating Egypt, but they were allies of Egypt. So, whenever he accepts the crown of the pharaohs, he starts construction on Alexandria. Yes, the same Alexandria where the lighthouse was, the same Alexandria where Apollos was from. This is the city of Alexandria that is going to be built here. He made a pilgrimage to the oracle at the Siwa Oasis, Egypt's holiest shrine. So he, not only did he come in and act as a liberator, he also was willing to pay homage to their oracles, to respect what they did there. Jewish tradition shows Alexander in a friendly light, although Hellenism was to become a great enemy of Orthodox Judaism. In 331 BC, and I want to bring this up for you because each year of Alexander's rule, you're going to watch him conquer a lot more territory at a time. So in 331 BC, I want you to look at this. It shows just how far down he had conquered. Alexander retraces his steps northward through Palestine and Syria. He attacks the Persian army in its home territory. He took the entire territory of Persia, the capitals of the Persian Empire, Babylon, Susa, Persepolis, and Ecbatana. All of these were successfully taken by Alexander. So you can see on here, Egypt is now green, like the rest of, like a good portion of Turkey, Macedonia, Greece. All of that is now under Alexander's control. Now keep in mind, he came to his throne in 336 BC. This is 331. Don't lose the magnitude of just how quickly and how efficiently this man conquered territory. He is a military genius to be able to pull something like this off. Now granted, Persia at this point was on the decline. They had riots all over the place. Yes, they had their own problems, but at the same time, to beat an army more than 10 times your size, it was a remarkable military strategist. So with the conquest of Persia behind him, Alexander continued eastward. And he is going to push into Bactria and Sogdiana. It's going to cost him 3 years, however. He gets all the way to the Punjab region of India. And that was the limit of his conquest. So let's go ahead and jump ahead. We're going to look now at around 324. I'm going to move the map a little bit. We're going to cut out Spain and England. And we're going to be looking mainly at the Persian entirety. And you're going to see just how far he pushes from Greece and where all he goes. And I apologize for the computer speed. It is an old computer. Okay, so you see the Nanda Kingdom over there. I don't know if you can see it or not. There is a river right here which forms this border. All right, that's the Indus River. When we look at 324? By the time Alexander was done conquering, he pushes from his territory, the green area, all the way over there. Do I need to pedal, or is there like a... there something I can... There we go. Okay, so the line shows... You can see the lines showing where all he went, where all he conquered. He pushed from here all the way to there. He's going to touch modern-day China, by the way, right there. So if you can imagine where Greece is today, and imagine that going all the way to China, that's about where his empire stretched. Remarkable to do in such a short amount of time. He came to his throne in 336, and by 324 was looking at that. I can't think of another, I cannot think of one other conqueror who did something like that. In at the Indus River, though, his soldiers, who were fiercely loyal to him, Alexander, unlike any other military general I can think of, he did not lose a battle. He was undefeated, which is remarkable. Now, that may mean that he knew how to pick his battles, and I think at the Indus River, maybe his own soldiers had a hand in that, because they were met looking over that river. They were looking at a very vast Indian army of elephants and some very frightening numbers. And it could be that his soldiers said, "We haven't seen home. That's not a good alternative. We're done." And at this point, they do not revolt, but they refuse to go any further. So, at the Indus River, they have to turn around and they begin to head back. And that is going to be your purple line up there. So they refuse to go any further. He takes them through the Baluchistan Desert. He had gradually come to see he could not simply rule the Persian Empire as a conquered territory of Macedonia. He wanted to... And originally, he wanted to rule it similar to how you see it right now. Macedonia and conquered territory. Or all Macedonia. But he realized it can't work like that. It's too much territory. So he would need both east and west, eastern and western officials governing it. So what he does is he takes Asians and Europeans. He gives them the education of... or Hellenization. He Hellenizes them. He takes to wearing Persian clothes, which the Greeks regarded as silly and effeminate. He also seemed to enjoy the ceremonies of the Persian court. 3,000 Persians were taught Greek and instructed in Western military science. Notice who instructs who on military science. It was a Greek philosophy, a Greek line of thought. It says that a Persian noble was even promoted into his inner circle of advisors. However, the Greeks regarded this as a fierce betrayal, because, after all, who had been the noted enemy of Greece for as long as any of them had been alive? It was Persia. And then to see them conquer them, you're going to raise one of them up to rule? That didn't go over well with them. When he reached Susa, in 324 B.C., he tries to consolidate his vast domains. He took Barsine, the daughter of Darius III, as his second wife. 80 officers and 10,000 other veterans took Persian wives on the same day in a ceremony portrayed as a marriage between East and West. He reorganized his army. He issued coins. He built a merchant fleet. He dug new irrigation canals. And he made plans to conquer Arabia. This is the one area that even the Romans would not go into, not because they were just that good of soldiers. It was the fact that what's in Arabia?
Deserts.
And unless you're going to go along the coast, there's really no reason to go down there and even mess with those tribes. There's really no reason for it. There was nothing. And until oil was discovered there, people kind of avoided Arabia. There really was no reason to go there. And so now what? When oil's discovered, oh man, it becomes a hotbed. And you all know that. Inspecting a drainage project near Babylon, a mosquito bit him, but he presumably caught malaria. And this is supposed to be what killed him. I'm not convinced. I don't buy the malaria thing. I think he was poisoned. Because they knew what malaria was, and he did not show all the symptoms of malaria. So you don't label something as, oh, well, it was malaria. Well, did it look like all these other malaria cases? Well, no. Well, it probably wasn't malaria. It was probably, it showed signs of being a type of poison as well. So I think he was probably poisoned. The 11 years of his amazing conquest changed the course of history. He died at the age of 32. Can you imagine? Cyrus came into his reign at 40. So, what this man did from 20 to 32, unmatched. Alexander never seemed to give much thought to the idea that his empire would exist without him. At least, he left it ill-prepared to face that situation. On his deathbed, man, does he throw a wrench into things, because he has asked on his deathbed who would inherit the throne. Alexander said, and all he said was, the strongest. And you can probably imagine why he said that, because what did he start with? A little bitty spot over here, and he carved an empire out of what he had. So you can imagine his contempt for successorship by saying, I carved an empire. I was stronger than them. The strongest will rule. And so that was his philosophy on it. And so that leads to the next period of bitter and bloody history that we're going to look at. And that is going to be the years of the Diadochi. The Diadochi simply means the successors. It is the four successors that we're going to examine. And by 315 BC, we find them dividing out that empire right there into their own realms. The four Diadochi are Cassander of Macedonia, Lysimachus of Thrace, Ptolemy the First of Egypt, and Seleucus of, really, he's going to form the Seleucid Empire. So we'll just say of the Seleucid Empire. These individuals are going to hold these areas. Seleucus, I guess you can say this, Syria and the rest of the Eastern Empire. You're going to see it in just a second. So for a while, they ruled as the Diadochi, largely over their own territories, but they quickly realized the foolishness of that. That there's no point in trying to hold something together with four heads. And that's what you're also going to read about, however, if you're still in Daniel 8, I don't know if your Bible's still open to Daniel 8. In verse 8 it says, therefore the male goat grew very great, but when he became strong, the large horn, who was that?
Alexander,
the large horn, was broken. And in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. Now, I'm being generous by saying he prophesied this at 500 BC, because he didn't. He prophesied even earlier than that. If he had prophesied this at 400 BC or 500 BC, do you realize he is telling you what is happening almost 200 years in advance? Even if he was around, let's say Daniel didn't say that, and it was some other Daniel at the end of the Persian Empire, how was he supposed to know that four generals of Alexander's were going to succeed? How did he know that Alexander wouldn't simply say, my son will succeed? He couldn't have known that. Nobody could have known that. And his life would have been on the line had he said that to Alexander or to anybody at that time of saying, well, Alexander's not going to appoint his own son. He's going to appoint four of his generals. And on top of that, he didn't even appoint those generals. They all pretty much they carved out their own. So understand the value of biblical prophecy is that sometime, probably around 530 or even before that, Daniel makes these prophecies. And when he does make those prophecies, how accurate is he?
Absolute.
It is absolute. He said exactly how many of these guys there would be. And so we find Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Seleucus taking control of this empire. All right, let's take a step back and then look at the Jews under the Ptolemies, because that would be the territory that Egypt would take. Whenever you think Egypt, don't you think of the square right here? You think of Egypt. Egypt in that time was more of what you see right here. It would go all the way up over Palestine. That was Egypt. That was the case in the days of Moses. So by the time they get out of the wilderness down here in Arabia, it's where Mount Sinai is, and they get up here, and Jericho says, keep them out. We heard about what happened in Egypt. Well, it makes sense, because they were under the jurisdiction, they were under control of Egypt. So the Jews now under the Ptolemies, that is the Hellenized pharaohs, the Grecian pharaohs, we're going to see what kind of treatment, what kind of rule they were under. For the most part, the Jews were permitted to live in peace and in accord with their religious and cultural traditions. Mark this, because this is not going to be the case. This is going to be dramatically different from what they were going to go through. Tribute was paid to the Egyptian governments, but local affairs were administered by the high priests, who had been entrusted with responsibility for the government of the Jews since Persian times. So they largely just left it to the high priests, who begin to act in place of a king. They didn't have a king, so the high priests really step in and begin to take on more of a political role than just a religious role. You're going to see that become more and more prominent throughout this time period. So we find that one great figure among the Jews of the Ptolemaic period is Simon the Just, the high priest who is the subject of the highest praise in post-biblical writings. Ecclesiasticus calls him great among his brethren and the glory of his people. He is credited with rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, again, which had been destroyed by Ptolemy the First. Who rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem the first time? Nehemiah. Ptolemy the First had destroyed Nehemiah's wall. So, what does Simon the Just do? This high priest begins to rebuild those walls of Jerusalem again. He is said to have repaired the temple and directed the excavation of a great reservoir which would provide fresh water for Jerusalem. So he was held in quite a bit of praise. Worth noting. Ptolemy's triumph in Palestine was short-lived. Palestine. Listen to that. I'm definitely from East Texas. It was short-lived. Antigonus drove him out of Syria and held it firmly. At this point, Antigonus would have been your fourth successor. The reason he's not named is because Seleucus was a general under Ptolemy. So the original four Diadochi, worth mentioning, is Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Antigonus. But Seleucus was allied, he was aligned under Ptolemy. These three are going to fight against Antigonus, and they're going to overthrow him. Seleucus is going to take his place, kind of succeeding him, taking a place as a Diadochi. So Antigonus drives Ptolemy out of Syria and holds on to that. Let's jump ahead to 311. And I'm hoping that it will split this big green blob into what they actually held, because it'll make it a lot more clear. It may not yet. Antigonus tried to stop Seleucus. He was unable to stop him. In 311 BC, Seleucus conquers Babylonia, marking the beginning of the Seleucid dynasty. If you're underlining, highlighting, whatever, you're going to want to highlight that. So the Seleucid Empire is going to play a very, very important role in Jewish policies, in their approach to Gentiles, in their treatment. It is going to play a huge part in that. So you're going to want to pay attention to the Seleucid dynasty. They're going to become very important. Antigonus, however, continued to hold Syria, which served as a wedge between the holdings of Ptolemy and Seleucus. So you can imagine that, you probably can't see from that far, the Tigris and Euphrates rivers right here, so Babylon would have been in here. Egypt is down here. Well, Syria is right in between. And so Antigonus held Syria, keeping them apart from each other because they were allies. That was pretty good spot to hold for Antigonus. However, 301 BC is the Battle of Ipsus, not Issus. Issus was when Persia lost control to Alexander the Great. Ipsus is whenever Antigonus is going to be killed. He's going to be removed from the spotlight, and we're going to see Seleucus really step in and claim his territories as his own. So in 301 BC, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Cassander, with their combined forces, met and overcame the forces of the aggressive Antigonus at the Battle of Ipsus. Antigonus died on the battlefield, and his Asiatic Empire came to an end. It had been agreed, and this is important to note, that Palestine would be given to Ptolemy if they won over Antigonus. But guess who didn't show up? Ptolemy didn't show up. And so they said, all right then, if Ptolemy's not going to show up, Seleucus, you get Palestine. So the Seleucid Empire expands then from Babylon to include Syria and Palestine. They're hitting a growth spurt. This leads to a war between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. So if you want to catch up in your notes to letter B of part 2, the war between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. I do want to stop and note, does anybody see anything of import on this map right now that we have not pointed out yet?
Rome is growing.
Rome is growing. It was a little red strip along the coast, but now it's expanded. Be watching Rome, because they're going to continue growing. They're going to get bigger and bigger. And by the time we hit 270 BC, they're going to control almost all of Italy. And so just have an eye open for that, because they're going to be growing. They're going to be expanding. All right, war broke out between the Seleucids and Ptolemies when it was learned that Berenice, Ptolemy II's daughter, had been murdered with her infant son through the intrigue of Laodice, half-sister and wife of Antiochus II. Laodice wanted to ensure that her own son, rather than the son of Berenice, would succeed to the Syrian throne, so she murdered them. The murder of the daughter of the grandson of the pharaoh, Ptolemy II, however, was an outrage to the honor of the Egyptians, to the Ptolemies, and so they proceeded with the Laodicean War. Already, you're seeing the beginning of the conflict between these two groups. Daniel actually records the conflicts for you in chapter 11. Chapter 11 of Daniel will record the conflicts between the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemies. So that's what that pertains to. Important to know, important to read. But it is staggering in its detail of what's going to happen. So when you take that and you read about just the sheer detail, understand that each one of these is found in secular history, and it's backed up by secular history that indeed happened. Again, being nice, being far too generous, if he prophesied that at 500 BC, of which that would put him around, who knows, 120 years old when he prophesied that, he still knows what's going on a good 200 years in advance to these kinds of details. Fantastic piece of biblical prophecy. After a series of brilliant victories in which northern Syria was completely conquered, Ptolemy III was called back to Egypt to care for a local problem. Seleucus was able to regain the lost territories as far as south as Damascus, but he could not take southern Palestine. Peace was established in 240 BC, and no further attacks were made on Syria during Ptolemy III's reign. So we're going to jump forward to 240. And at this point, I know you're going to watch the empire split apart. Yeah. Don't let the size of it, all the colors, intimidate you. The Seleucid Empire that you remember from Babylon conquered Syria and now held the northern part of Palestine. You're going to see Macedonia and what is right here, Thrace. This is where Lysimachus Lysimachus was. This is where Cassander was. You got the Ptolemies down here, and you've got the Seleucids here. But you notice in the wake of that empire falling apart, all of these kingdoms open up, that they're all over the place. Something as small as Sinope and Byzantium, as large as Parthia. You're going to find these play notable parts in the coming conflict with Rome, which has dramatically grown. Now, we jumped from 301 all the way to 240, and yes, the boot is red now. The football is turning red. So they are battling it out with Carthage, which I map's only so big. Carthage was a Mediterranean commerce superpower, but Rome was going after them. And you've heard of Hannibal before? One of the greatest generals in history for marching elephants through the Alps into Rome. He is from Carthage. And he is going to be one of the enemies of Rome for a long time. Keep an eye out for that. All right. No further attacks were made on Syria during Ptolemy III's reign. In 221 BC, he is succeeded by Ptolemy IV, Philopater, one of the worst of the Ptolemaic house. Seleucus II was succeeded in 226 by his brother who would be known as Antiochus III, or Antiochus the Great. The Jews under the Seleucids. Let's look at part 3. All right, we got one page after this. We're almost finished. Antiochus III was only 18 years of age when he came to the throne of Syria in 223 BC. He had experience in government, because he had served under the ruler, or served as a ruler of Babylonia. So he knew what he was doing. I'm going to jump ahead to 223 BC. You're going to be seeing that map change in front of you. Antiochus began a campaign to conquer Palestine. He's the one who's going to push the fight with Egypt. And after having gotten as far as Philistia, which, if you remember, the Philistines were kind of on this northeastern border of Egypt. So that's about how far he wanted to go. He was pushing for that. He met Ptolemy Philopater south of Raphia. Here the armies of Antiochus met a disastrous defeat. For a number of years, he was busy in the east. He did not forget about Palestine, though. He just dropped it for the moment. At the death of Ptolemy IV in 203, Egypt was torn apart by turmoil, rebellion, by internal unrest. In the spring of 202, Antiochus launched an attack, which again accomplished nothing. You would think he would just leave Egypt alone, because he did not win very much against Egypt. But he's called the Great for a reason. So he continues to attack. He was finally victorious in the spring of 198 BC. In passing through his newly acquired territories, he came to Jerusalem where, according to Josephus, the inhabitants gave him a cordial and warm welcome. Now, I mean that to sound foreboding, because it is. They welcomed Antiochus the Great as if he was a conquering hero. But his son was going to do atrocious things to the Jews. So it's only sad that they welcomed him as they did. When Antiochus invaded Greece, because he was in a position to attack them at this point, Romans moved into Greece as well. You are seeing Rome begin to expand eastward. And they're going to be able to do that very quickly. He defeated Antiochus and forced him to retreat into Asia Minor. The younger son of Antiochus the Great, later to rule as Antiochus Epiphanes, was taken to Rome as a hostage for the payment of indemnity. His 12 years in Rome gave him a healthy respect for Roman power and Roman procedures. One of the reasons why Rome was able to beat Greece so well in this area is because at this point they had been, Alexander took one entire generation of men from that line. And then you have Lysimachus and Cassander splitting another generation and taking those entire generations to war. Who's left to fight against Rome? The door's wide open. There simply was not the manpower to stop Rome in their attack. Antiochus Epiphanes and the persecution of the Jews, our final section. The fall of Palestine into Syrian hands following the victory of Antiochus III at Panion in 198 ushered in a new era of Jewish history. The rule of the Ptolemies had been tolerant, but the Seleucids forced the Jews to accept Hellenism. Antiochus IV bore the name Epiphanes, or the Illustrious. The Jews gave him the nickname Epimenes, or Epimenes, the Madman. And they did that because they hated this man. Antiochus Epiphanes was not a foreigner, intent on enslaving a persecuted minority group. On the contrary, a sizable number of Jews were impressed with the possibilities of greater conformity to the Hellenistic manners and customs. In the early days of the reign of Antiochus IV, Jerusalem was ruled by the high priest Onias III. You may have heard me mention Onias III before. He is the rightful high priest, a descendant of Simon the Just and a strictly Orthodox Jew. The Jews, who looked favorably on Greek culture, opposed Onias and espoused the cause of his brother Jason. By promising larger tribute to Antiochus, Jason succeeded in having himself appointed high priest. You are beginning to see, at this moment, between Onias III and Jason, you are beginning to see the split in Judaism that would eventually lead to what two groups?
Pharisees and Sadducees.
The Pharisees and the Sadducees. These are the roots of it right here. Onias III is going to represent a group known as the Hasidim, which would be the holy ones, the separated ones. Well, I can't borrow the Pharisee term. That's what Pharisee means, is a separated one. They are the holy ones, the called out ones, the separated ones. That's the Hasidim. The Hellenists, however, are the Grecian Jews who wanted to incorporate Grecian ways of life, Grecian culture, and they're going to be the Sadducees. Jason encouraged the Hellenists who had sought his election. He began to introduce many Greek elements into Jewish society. With the developing tide of Hellenism, there was a resistance movement. Menelaus took over as high priest and courted the favor of Antiochus Epiphanes. Again, what are you seeing in the high priest's office at this point?
Corruption.
You're seeing a lot of corruption. With that political power to be able to rule Jerusalem, these guys begin to stoop to whatever level they want. Eventually it'll get to the point where they're willing to assassinate to get their way. At this point, it's simply bribes. Simply. Bribes are bad enough, but that's what they're doing, is they're bribing their way into an office and deposing the one who should have been there. One of Israel's darkest periods began under this rule, and this is going to, unfortunately, last for a while, but it's going to be met with by some Jews who are not happy with it. A systematic attempt was made to Hellenize the country by force. A bearded image of Jupiter, or a Romanized Zeus, was set up on the temple altar. An idol was put on the temple altar. Now, if you're a Jew who reveres the old law, what do you think of that? That, not in my house, right? That would be my reaction. Greek soldiers and their lovers performed licentious heathen rites in the temple courts. Swine were sacrificed on the altar. The drunken orgy associated with the worship of Bacchus or Dionysus was made compulsory. You have to do this. Conversely, the Jews were forbidden under penalty of death to practice circumcision, Sabbath observance, or the observance of the feasts of the Jewish year. Copies of the Hebrew scriptures were ordered destroyed. And they welcomed this man's father in the doors with open arms. Now you can see why I said it the way I did. By force of arms, the Hellenizing party had gained a victory. Menelaus continued as high priest. Where once his worship was directed to Jehovah, now he served Jupiter. Yet the Hellenizers had gone too far. Their very zeal for a quick defeat of the old order evoked a reaction which drove the Hellenizers out of power and brought into being an independent Jewish state, which would be known as the Hasmonean dynasty. The ones who drove them out, do you know who they are? First and second
Maccabees.
The first and second Maccabees, although they are not inspired books, make very good historical recordings of that time period, of whenever Mattathias, however you want to pronounce it, and his children would drive out these Hellenizers out of Palestine, that they would eventually drive them completely out. That's all I had for today. Any questions or any comments to be made right at 11 o'clock?
I have a question.
Certainly, go ahead.
You know, First and Second Maccabees, that's written. Mm-hmm. What else is written in the Apocrypha?
In the Apocrypha? Well, there's actually quite a few books.
Okay.
Now, not as many as what would be considered Apocryphal New Testament, because there was an explosion of literature written at that time and in between here. We don't have all of those apocryphal books, and we're going to look at that next, because whenever this Hellenizing stuff was going on, people started looking for the Messiah. They started looking for the one who would come, and you can see why now, drive these guys out and get rid of this and reconquer this territory for God. You can see why they wanted a military leader, because that's what they were surrounded by, is military Gentiles. And so you can understand why. Well, a lot of their apocryphal writings mirror that, and it reflects that. And so, not all of them. I mean, the First and Second Maccabees, the writer of it says, I was just trying to record an accurate history. If I did a good job, great. If not, well, I did the best I could. So he admits it's not an inspired book, by the way. So with that said, many of them claim to be inspired but are not. They contain several errors. But did I answer your question?
Sure.
Kind of. You can quickly find a list of them. Just a quick search on Google gets you an entire list of apocryphal books. You can also pick up a Catholic Bible, and that'll hold a lot of the intertestamental apocryphal books as well. Anything else? Anyone else? Anyone want to mention? That's Alexander. We're not done talking about Alexander. He will come up frequently because of what he spread, because of Hellenism. We're going to be mentioning Alexander again in the future. That's lesson 3. I appreciate everyone's attention this morning. I appreciate everyone's attendance for showing up. And it's been a good class. If you have any questions, just feel free to come ask me about it.